This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Hello?
The house is flooded.
In the summer of 2019, my house was flooded by Cyclone Geeta. It was devastating. My childhood toys, books, my mum's wedding rings, all gone. The house I grew up in, wiped off the map. At 10 years old, I couldn't grasp how one storm could change everything. Then came the thieves, looting what little we had left. The insurance battle dragged on for 4 years. They said we could restore the house, but council wouldn't allow it. We lived in our shed over that time until we finally took whatever payout we could get and rebuilt higher and further back from the ocean. But climate change isn't some far-off thing. It's already here. According to NIWA, New Zealand's National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, sea levels around New Zealand have risen 20 centimetres in the last century, and they're expected to go up another 30 centimetres by 2050. In 2022, Westport saw its worst flood in over 50 years, with 826 properties flooded and forced evacuation of over 2,000 people. In the following days, 563 houses were assessed as either red or yellow, meaning they were significantly or moderately damaged. The next year, a similar occurrence happened when Cyclone Gabrielle hit the North Island. Areas in Auckland, Northland, Bay of Plenty, Opotiki District, Whakatane District, Waikato District, Hauraki District, Tarawhiti and Tārua District were placed in a state of emergency. Thousands of homes were flooded throughout these towns and 11 people were killed. It is estimated that 20,000 homes are now flood-prone after Cyclone Gabrielle. Even rural GPs are seeing the impacts firsthand. In fact, a 2023 study found that rural health workers are increasingly dealing with climate-related stress and illness, especially after extreme events like flooding and droughts. And this isn't just a bad year or a freak accident. This is part of a pattern, one we're seeing not just in New Zealand, but worldwide. This brings us to the big question. How do small towns survive when climate change is taking away their land that they're built on? NIWA is currently predicting that coastal communities will experience up to 1 metre of sea level rise by 2100, which would permanently flood low-lying suburbs. And with this trend accelerating globally, some New Zealand insurers are already refusing to cover flood-prone properties. But what is climate change, really? Climate change refers to long-term shifts in temperature and weather patterns. And while natural events like volcanic activity and solar variation plays a role, the overwhelming consensus is that human activity over the last 150 years is the main driver of recent changes, mainly from burning fossil fuels and cutting down forests. This is all due to greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, methane and nitrous oxide, as these gases trap heat in our atmosphere, causing what's known as the greenhouse effect. That's why we're seeing record-breaking heatwaves, stronger storms and more frequent flooding events like the ones in Westport and Auckland. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've pumped so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that levels are now 50% higher than they were before we started burning coal, oil and gas at massive scales. The scary part: the last time CO2 levels were this high, sea levels were about 20 metres higher than they are today. And we're already seeing the consequences. 2023 was one of the hottest years on record, with brutal heatwaves in Europe, devastating wildfires in Canada, and extreme weather battering communities around the world. Scientists say that the planet has already warmed by 1.1 degrees Celsius since the late 19th century, and if we cross the 1.5 degrees threshold, things could spiral into an irreversible catastrophe with widespread droughts, food shortages, and entire coastal cities swallowed by the ocean. With the ocean rising faster than ever and melting ice caps pushing sea levels up by 3.3 millimetres per year, this threat is becoming more and more real. Warmer ocean temperatures are also supercharging storms and making hurricanes, cyclones and typhoons stronger and more frequent. Basically, the more heat our planet absorbs, the more chaos we unleash on our weather, our homes and our future. Ultimately, what that means for small towns like Westport is more severe storms. Climate change will intensify the storms because warmer air holds more moisture, leading to heavier rainfall and more extreme flooding events. Westport is an example of how small towns face the worst damage with fewer resources to rebuild. The town sits on a low-lying plain with where the Bulla and Orawaiti River meet the sea. This geographical feature means that even moderate rises in river and sea level lead to widespread flooding. And being a small town, we have limited resources to spend on flood defence measures. On the flip side, climate change can result in more droughts as rising temperature dries out the soil faster, reducing water availability. This can threaten agriculture and make it hard for rural farmers to grow crops and keep livestock alive. Both farming and fishing are industries that sustain many rural communities and are at serious risk as droughts and heatwaves are making it harder to grow crops and ocean warming and acidification are disrupting fish populations. Small towns that rely on these industries will see jobs disappear, forcing families to move. A New Zealand Treasury's report from 2021 concluded that climate change threatens 1 in 6 jobs in New Zealand due to its impacts on farming, tourism and fisheries. That's a lot of jobs. And New Zealand isn't alone in this. Around the world, coastal towns like mine are disappearing. Small communities that rely on stable weather, like farmers and fishing villages, are struggling to survive. If we keep on going at this rate, millions of people will be displaced in the next few decades. As droughts increase, so does the risk of wildfires. Rural areas surrounded by forests and grasslands are especially vulnerable. Entire communities are being wiped out, like what we've seen in Australia and North America. There will also be more coastal erosion. As sea levels rise, coastlines are eroding. Places like Westport and Hawke's Bay are already seeing homes claimed by the sea. Some towns may be forced to relocate entirely. And Westport has stepped up to take action by creating a long-term strategic plan led by the Bulla District Council to guide the future development of Westport, New Zealand, by focusing on community wellbeing, economic growth and resilience to flooding. The plan, developed with community input, considers options for lower-risk areas for growth and relocation, while also supporting Westport's role as a key service hub and port. For Westport, we have a hard decision to make and limited time on our hands. Joining me now is Paul Zannon, a climate expert who works on small town relocation and flood prevention. Thank you for being here. Okay, first question. Westport, where I live, is already planning to relocate parts of the town. What does that actually look like?
It's a really, really complicated one. So Westport has a series of different hazards. Some of those hazards are here today, so from the flooding events that we had in 21 and 22. But with the projections of climate change, those hazards are exacerbated. They basically get worse over time. Not all hazards are the same in Westport. So it is on a floodplain. So that means we've got liquefaction concerns, we've got river flooding, we've got rain flooding. But it's groundwater that's a really big one here. So for Westport, certain parts of it will be here for a very, very, very long time. So all the areas around the port are actually a little bit higher than other parts of town as well. And even the soil typology is different in parts of town. So some of it is river run. So when you get an earthquake, it doesn't turn to liquefaction. Other parts is like reclaimed land. So under certain scenarios, certain parts of town are going to have a really, really hard time. So in the project that we've all collectively been involved in, we've had to be really honest about that and go, look, here's the current hazards. Here's what we can do about them today. So some of the hazards we can actually mitigate. When you forecast ahead, some of the hazards cannot be mitigated. It's not because the engineering doesn't exist. It's because of the cost. So we have a real small population. We've got like 4,800 odd people live in Westport. We can't defend here like they can in the Netherlands, where they have 17 million people, a really small country, and they've got a tax that pays for it all. So they can defend for a very, very long time. Here, if we start mapping over a gradual increase of 10 centimetres, 20, 30, 70 centimetres, we start having insurmountable problems. And then you get a vulnerability on all your infrastructure and then some serious health concerns. So if the groundwater comes too close to the house, you get things like black mould. So we know that we have today's challenges, but we also know we have challenges in the future. So what we started exploring in that project is not actually taking all of that granular information and trying to hyper-explain it to people. It was about running a series of different scenarios, not predictions. So we went, well, what if? And then what if? And in the background, we started crunching some of those numbers. There is a tipping point that it just isn't doable anymore. So what we've tried to do is look at what we've looked at, basically a growth strategy. So where do we start opening up new areas? Where do we start running infrastructure? How do we actually have a better economic output through going for some really well-managed growth? So that growth has to be for here. It's not for anyone else. It's for Westport. But how do we bring people to this area, start opening up new blocks of land that people can start growing into, and then over time, as the hazards show up and they are measurable, they're impactful and they're felt, then we can start looking at equity transfer. So how do we get the land value from point A to point B? Still doesn't take care of the above ground, so the house, etc. for people, but it is a gradual change. So we can go faster if we need to. So if we have an earthquake and we have a hazard that has shown up, people can take their EQC money or their insurance money and go to another spot. But if we don't have another spot ready, we're left really, really vulnerable. There's a lot of sort of nuanced thinking as well in terms of how do you move people's emotional kind of connection to communities? Like, people live where they live for a reason most of the time. You know, it's their neighbourhoods, it's their sense of belonging and identity to those. You can't just cut and paste that to somewhere else. So we learned this in Christchurch as well, where 6,000 homes went out of the residential red zone and they scattered to other parts of the Canterbury district. A lot of people ended up moving back close to the hazards that they'd felt because they'd lost their sense of identity and community as well. The one thing we have here is a bit of a luxury of time. So it doesn't all have to be done in one big hit. It doesn't have to be a big trauma. We can actually look at what we refer to as transformative adaptation. How can we take care of some of the other issues in Westport around deprivation and economic standings as well, and try and better those at the same time as what we're trying to provide safety and security for people as well. So we're pretty lucky here that we've got a lot of land, you know, really, really close to where we are at the moment. But it's getting people over a period of time used to it. And then it's also working with the finance and the insurance sectors as well. So remembering that the biggest owner of property in most of New Zealand is the banks. They own it until you pay it off. So they actually also have a role to play here. If they want to keep finance going, well, maybe they have to contribute and be part of the solution as well. Everybody has something to gain and everybody has something to lose here. So for Westport, it is a gradual and incremental change. So if you move the dial 1%, that starts compounding year after year after year. And you find over 50 years, you've actually moved a long way from your original point. So it's a lot slower here. It's not something that we're advocating a fast shift. And this is the hard part to kind of talk with communities about as well. You can't just lift and shift $1.5 billion worth of stuff up to a new location by clicking your fingers and hoping it works well. There's emotional context, there's physical context as well. So, yeah, that's kind of how we've been approaching what we kind of look at a growth and relocation scenario mixed together.
Cool. So what about towns that potentially, like, can't relocate? If they don't have the space or the money, how can we deal with that?
This is what people in government, different agencies and communities have been trying to tackle for a very long period of time. So I've only been sort of working in this field for probably 15, 18 years. And well before that, those same questions were posed. How do we do this in different communities? So the response for Westport is not applicable to other communities. Like you said, they might not have the luxury of land like we do. There will be bespoke different ways to approach adaptation in different communities. It can't be one size fits all, and I think that's where a lot of people have got it wrong. Some of the fundamentals stay the same. That moving somebody's equity from point A to point B is really, really complicated.
Yeah.
And who pays for that? You know, is that a shared burden? And where is the line in that? So if you've bought something that you know is in a hazard area, and you've still bought it, is that a collective problem or an individual problem? So when you sort of start scratching your back, it's really, really, really complicated. I think my biggest advice for other communities is to make sure you have the conversation, to take your time, to make sure it's not a threat-based conversation. It's not just about data and you're all doomed. But it's starting to tease out what the hopes and aspirations of the individual and the collective is as well. Each community will have a solution, but you can't superimpose that on it. Even if you think you've got the solution, without having people understanding, wanting to be a part of it, the solution doesn't get actioned either. So it's really hard. Like, we can pick different villages and different towns around the country, but they all need to have that work done in the community, from the community, and that will spit out an outcome over time. It will be harder for some than others.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely guaranteed. You think of somewhere like Wellington. Yeah. Like, their hazard exposure is huge. And then the commercial centres, etc. And where do you move that to, and how do you do that? So it's a really difficult question. Yeah. And I'm always really shy of that one, because I don't believe that the same solution applies to different communities. It might do, but until you work with a community, you're never going to find that out.
Yeah. So from your work, are there any other examples? You talked about Christchurch, of small towns that have like successfully adapted or like bounced back.
From lots of different hazards, absolutely. Mm. So Christchurch is a relevant example for me, obviously, being from there. There is a trauma that goes with it, and that should never be overlooked. You know, people's lives are upended, they were stressed, and that still continues to today. But there's been some amazing stuff come out of that as well. Certainly for the Central Business District in Christchurch, it's found a whole new life. And the one thing is after a disaster, the government checkbook comes out, and all of a sudden the upgrades to infrastructure start happening that might not have. But I've seen pockets of amazing in Christchurch since the earthquakes. There's that old saying, you know, these things do bring communities together in times of stress. And I've seen that in Christchurch. Internationally, there's definitely examples of where this has been done. So Australia has some really interesting examples of where they've basically enabled new townships to be built that were better than the original townships. So that's that saying of transformative adaptation. I think we always look at the threat of this and that we lose hope and choice and self-determination. If you can keep those at the core of any of these projects, that's what we call transformation. So, yeah, there are plenty of case studies. I think we researched about 36 different case studies nationally and internationally throughout making the master plan, just to have a good look around what had worked in other areas and what hadn't worked in other areas. I mean, Buller itself is interesting. You know, we've had the rise and fall of many different settlements here over time as well, and I think that's a hard thing for people when you have short-term thinking. You don't realise that there's history where townships have already moved here many times. Westport itself has already retreated from the ocean from where it originally was founded. So you can do better in these. There are examples of it. In terms of climate adaptation, it's a hard one because I think we're only just starting to feel the impacts these days. They will get heavier over time. But I think the earlier you start the conversations, the more likely you are to have a better outcome. But yeah, there's definitely examples. And really close to home as well.
Yeah, cool. So don't you think that it's unfair that small towns and lower income communities who contribute the least to global emissions end up being the ones that suffer the most? How can we mitigate that?
Interesting question. absolutely. So this is something you see internationally as well, where, you know, first world countries, although we might not produce the emissions here, we are responsible for those emissions because we are a consumer-based society. So for New Zealand, our local emissions aren't much, but if you actually look at where we buy products from, whether it's from India or China or something similar, where you go, well, wait a second, are we not technically still responsible because we're the consumer of the product made there? And I think this is the challenging part of what's happened over the last 60 years. We have become global, truly global. The information is instantly global. Transport is not far off instantly global. You know, we can move around the world so fast and so can the products. But that's where the shared responsibility comes through, in my opinion. So for little communities like Westport, where, yeah, our emissions are a heck of a lot lower than a country that has a billion people in it, but we still have a shared responsibility. And this is something, the Gaia theory, you know, we actually live on one habitable sphere floating in the middle of nowhere together. And this is something about that collectivism at a planetary scale. We don't have a plan B. This is what we have. So it might not be our fault. It certainly is a problem for us all. But we start seeing these conversations are starting to happen about actually sharing this planet and actually having a really good navel gaze about who's causing the impact, what the kickback of that is. There's certain initiatives that have been done internationally around emissions offsets and trading and yada yada. That is, in my opinion, an attempt at that. It's starting to go, well, there's externalities, is what they're referred to, from industry. They don't show up in accounting books, but somebody has to pay somewhere along the way. So, yeah, those externalities is essentially what we've got with climate change. We've produced a bunch of stuff, we've used a bunch of resources for a series of outcomes, but it's got a sting in the tail. It's got a cost that's more than just financial. It is global in impact. But it's also hard when you start pointing the finger. The one thing I've noticed is if you're yelling from opposite sides of the room, you will never achieve an outcome. So trying to point the finger at who's responsible for what and when is not actually a collaborative way to get to an outcome, because everybody entrenches and where they are. Nobody likes being told off. Like, nobody. I hate it so much. And if I start getting told off or yelled at, my defences come up. And that's something we were so careful in that conversation we all had. This wasn't about finger pointing. It wasn't pointing backwards to go, the previous generation was responsible for their decisions. We all are. And I think there's a better way to have that conversation than we did or didn't cause the impact. We're all going to feel this. So why wouldn't we actually kind of collectively work together on that answer?
Yeah, I totally agree. So as a teenager in Westport, I can't vote, I don't have money. What can I do to start making a difference?
I think if you take the I out of it and look at your generation, because you already have, you have been part of this project. So you have had input, you have influenced things. And that's the reassurance we tried to give to yourself, to your other friends that came to the workshops, and also the Youth Council as well. You do have the ability to introduce change. In this project specifically, we have tried to really honour that and say that your opinion is valued and it is valuable to a process. You see the world different than I do. My ideologies are more entrenched than yours. You're a cleaner intellectual slate, if you will. So if you take yourself as an individual out of it, because you are contributing already, you're actively thinking about it, you're discussing it, and you're influencing a project and a set of outcomes. I think for the youth, it's a really hard lesson. It took me a long time to learn, was to stop pointing the finger at my dad for mistakes and taking learnings from previous generations. So it's not about attacking. It's not about blaming, but it is about learning. We can learn from other people's mistakes really easily without judgment, and therefore we learn and we grow from that. I think keeping your eyes open to that is really, really important. So it's not about having to yell at a government or yell at an institution or anything like that, but it's going, okay, we can be honest about a problem definition at least. If we can do that, and if the youth can be honest about the problem definition, there are ways that you can influence. At the moment you can't vote, pretty shortly you will be able to. You can still participate in things though. So when surveys are sent out from local body, so from councils or something similar, this is something that I think is really important, is the education of civics, is to go, you might not be able to vote, but you can still have influence. So I think that's something people don't appreciate enough. You do have influence, it's just you have to know how to use that influence as well. I wish that this government, while they were teaching financial literacy, would also be teaching civics literacy. Because I think that is the future, about a more participatory form of democracy. If we want to solve these really hard conversations, a dictatorial approach is not going to work. But for the youth of today, like, yeah, you are inheriting your previous generations and the generations before them decisions. There are good things and good decisions that have happened over time and good outcomes. But hoo-wee, yeah, your generation has a journey to go on as well. I think the biggest thing you can do is buddy up with those different age groups, because one thing that I certainly did at your age was that kind of like it was the previous generation, and yeah, they had power and influence and I didn't, but now it's my turn to sit in that seat, you know, being in my mid-40s, and it's a scary place because with influence comes responsibility, and boy, that's taken me a long time. So I think it's also just sharing those learnings from other people, the good and the bad. Like, there's a lot of people from previous generations who've done some amazing things, and it's learning and growing off of that. but the honesty for your generation to have a good, robust look at what the physical problems are in respect to climate change. But there's also, and this is a really hard part, is around that personal responsibility, right? So one person not using rare earth minerals or not buying the latest this or that, one person doesn't make an impact. But I think it's also a recalibration specifically for arguably my and your generations is about what our value system is. What is it that's important? Is it rampant consumerism? Is it hyper-individualism? Or is there a better model that we actually need to explore? There's examples of really good models, but you need to advocate for those over time as well. So as you study, as you learn, as you grow, as you start being able to vote, there's more than just showing up once every 3 years. It's about participation. And through that participation, I genuinely believe you can get influence.
Awesome. Thank you. Lastly, one more question. What is something that gives you hope for the future? Because it's easy to get overwhelmed by all of this, you know, going on.
For me, I think it is that learning that, there is a genuine desire for betterment that sits in communities, like a genuine desire. So there are some commonalities that I've found through, I don't know, 100,000 conversations over 15 years with different communities and different people. Everybody actually can come to some common agreements. So if you can find that neutrality of communities where they might want betterment, and it's that simple and broader statement, you know, they want to have a meaningful, happy, purposeful life without the stresses that kind of come sometimes with the world that we live in these days. It gives me great hope that all of my career has been at street level, that I've talked and engaged with so many different people from different ideological backgrounds, from different upbringings, from different socioeconomic standpoints. But there's always a desire for betterment. If you can strip the individual out and start looking at it at a community lens, that's something that gives me great hope. Because with that commonality of desire is what we can help to shape the world. It doesn't have to be confrontational. If you can strip the ideologies and the confrontation points, you end up in a really beautiful conversation with people. And that is achievable.
So, where does that leave us? For small towns like Westport, climate change isn't just about melting ice caps or far-off disasters. It's about whether we have homes in 10 years. And that's where the economic disparity between rural and urban areas comes in. Cities get the bulk of funding for climate resilience, for things like seawalls, flood defences and emergency response systems, while small towns are often left behind. This means rural communities have fewer resources to rebuild after disasters, making it harder to recover. According to a report by the University of Otago, this creates a growing inequality in how we respond to climate disasters. Rural towns struggle to secure climate adaptation funding, and when disaster strikes, they're often at the bottom of the priority list. Governments need to step up, whether it's funding managed retreat for at-risk communities, or supporting local renewable energy products that reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, or even making sure small towns aren't left out of big climate action plans. But small towns aren't completely helpless. The same report by Otago University highlights how rural resilience isn't just about resources. It's about strong social networks, local action, and knowledge passed down over generations. The more we talk about it, the more we push for change, the better chance we have at protecting our communities. Indigenous communities and rural towns have been dealing with environmental change for generations. Māori knowledge, Mātauranga Māori, includes centuries of observations about weather patterns, ocean currents, and sustainable resource management. By combining traditional wisdom with modern science, we can create better climate solutions that actually work for local communities. Grassroots movements like the Westport Master Planning Workshops are stepping up. By bringing together communities to have the hard talks about the future, we are able to make the first steps in finding long-term solutions. By rebuilding sustainably further and higher away from the ocean, we not only protect our town, but we have the opportunity to start fresh with eco-friendly living and building solutions. And it's not just Westport. Communities all over New Zealand are pushing for local renewable energy products, building their own flood defences and demanding policy changes. From installing solar panels to organising local climate action groups, small towns are proving that resilience isn't just about money, it's about people coming together. This is happening, and whether or not the government steps up, we have to start making choices now. The water's rising. The question isn't whether we'll act, it's whether we'll act in time.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.